That's problematic. And also at the same time, when that's happening, then these trees aren't photosynthesizing. They're not taking in carbon, so they're also getting weakened from that process too.
Yeah, I mean, that was such a scary eye-opener, that heat dome. And that really does, like you said a minute ago, bring it back to that bigger picture. As we start to wrap up, just bringing it all the way back to the Forest Service, to these wildfire treatments, almost everyone agrees something has to be done. You know, we have locked in, no matter what we do today, tomorrow, the rest of this century, we have locked in a certain amount of climate chaos here, and we are going to be seeing these massive tree die-offs. We are going to, there's no way to avoid some of the things that are coming down the pipe. And so it's not a question of should we just let nature take its course or not. I firmly think that we have to do something. We have an obligation to the natural world. But the question is what to do, who has the trust and credibility to act, you know, and what are our incentives and values there? So I think that is a through line between all of the things that we've talked about today. And I've really appreciated getting to have this conversation with you. Your work is excellent. And you also, in addition to writing for Columbia Insight, have your own personal website that folks can go to. Can folks find all of these articles that we've talked about at your personal website? And what is that?
I mean, eventually when I update my website, it's nathangillis.com.
Great. Well, like I said, I've really enjoyed talking with you, and I really encourage folks to go to nathangillis.com and read your work, to go to Columbia Insight, read your work there. So thank you so much for joining us on Coast Range Radio. I hope we can have you back again.
All right, thanks for having me.
And that's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Once again, that Northwest Forest Plan comment period ends on March 17th. Please take a few minutes and take action to let the Forest Service know your values for how we should be managing forests in the Northwest. Again, my email is michael@coastrange.org. Drop me a line anytime, and we will be back with a new episode next week. Thank you so much for listening.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April 15, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers that make KBOO, KBOO. If you'd like to listen to all the fabulous specials, go to kboo.fm/ATNF4.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hey, Stephen.
We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today, we have Molly Katzman and Susanna Kassoff. Welcome.
Hi.
Yeah, great to have you both. So would you start out by just telling our listeners about what your role or job is in education, and also if you currently play any role in your union?
All right. This is Molly, and I am currently a full-time substitute teacher throughout schools in the Portland metro area. I used to teach eighth grade language arts and social studies. So I only substitute teach high school currently. And I am a PAT union member, but not otherwise involved with the union.
Great.
And I'm Susanna Kasouf. I teach social studies at Grant High School. Molly and I actually went to grad school together. And I am currently a building rep. I became a rep after the strike this year.
Gotcha. And my apologies for mispronouncing your
name. That's okay.
And tell us what inspired you to go into education and how long have you been in education?
Molly, you want to go?
Go for it, Sue.
Okay. This is my fourth year teaching. And, you know, I got involved in education because I believe that educators and education can change the world. I'm a social studies teacher. I have studied the history of social movements, and I've seen, you know, with my own two eyes that we all have the power to change the world and to change the way things are. And my background is in activism. I did a lot of climate justice activism over the years. And now I feel actually that my activism is teaching. You have such an amazing opportunity as a teacher to have a year-long relationships with 130 to 150 kids. And I think those kinds of relationships can be really transformational. And so that's why I'm a teacher.
Great. Thank you for that. So around the country, educators...
Wait, Molly.
Look, here we have Susie amplifying what a powerful educator she is, right? She don't leave anyone behind, no students left behind, or colleagues. Thank you, Susie. Appreciate you. So yeah, Susanna and I, we went to graduate school together. And I think we graduated in 2020. And yeah, you know, and Susanna so eloquently sort of explained, right, why so many of us are educators. So, you know, I often think about personally, like that quote by Toni Morrison, I will probably botch it, something like, if you're free, it's your job to free somebody else. If you have power, your job is to empower others. You know, and that I often come back to that when I think about why I got into education. So, yep. All right.
Great. Thank you, Molly. So as both of you are aware, I think, you know, both at the college and K-12 levels, teachers are being targeted for speaking out and for teaching, posting, wearing, displaying things related to Palestine. And so that's why we wanted to have you both on the show. But we wanted to first acknowledge that this kind of targeting can be really hard, and it can feel scary, it can feel isolating. And so we just want to thank you for your willingness to come on the show.
Thank you. Yeah, it can be really scary. So thank you.
So just to start off with, can you tell us about your connections, if any, to Palestine and or Israel? And if that plays a part in your caring about the genocide that's going on today? Were you involved with Palestinian liberation before October 7th?
Yeah, I mean, to sort of put it bluntly, my connection to Israel, as a Jewish American person, my connection is that I could move there tomorrow and I could have more rights in Israel, as an American citizen than any Palestinian person who has lived there on that land for their entire lives. So unfortunately, I do have a connection to Israel that I wish I didn't have, you know, and because of that, I do feel a real responsibility to speak out against Israel and Zionism and the current genocide. And so, you know, I've been, you know, sort of peripherally involved in Palestinian liberation movements, Jewish Voice for Peace in particular, for many years, pretty much, you know, ever since I learned about the occupation and the Nakba and, you know, really just all of the horrors that take place over there. But definitely since October 7th, my activism in the movement has gotten a lot more involved.
Thanks, Molly. We connected on that really early after we met. So I'm Arab American, but my mom, who's Arab, you know, through a series of different assimilation projects, didn't have too much of the culture as I was growing up. We had the food. So I never learned about Palestine growing up. And then when I was in college, I took a class on the Arab-Israeli conflict, and the teacher really tried hard to be very neutral. But still, by the end of the class, I was like, seems like this isn't great for Palestinians. And I remember writing my final paper on Christian Zionism. And then, you know, years later, a few years ago, I made a really good friend who was Palestinian. And she told me all about, you know, her experience as an American citizen, being Palestinian, going to visit family in Palestine, and just the way that she would be detained at checkpoints and harassed and degraded. And I talked with her parents about, you know, being kicked out of their homes during the Nakba, and how if somebody in her family actually had the opportunity at one point to go back to the home that they were kicked out of, and a Jewish family was living there with their furniture, with some of their same decorations still in the house. And just hearing all these stories from her and what her and her family faced, I became very passionate about what Palestinians are going through. But then since October 7th, really, my level of knowledge was not where it is now, because after October 7th happened and my students were very curious about it, I've always felt that it's my job to explain the world to my students, you know, historical context for the world. And so they were curious about it and they wanted to learn about it. And I have many, many Jewish students. I have no Arab students this year, and many Jewish students. So I was also very curious, what is this side of the story? And I want to understand where they're coming from. And I want to make sure that I'm making them feel safe and understood. And since then, I have learned so much. And it's unfathomable what Palestinians are going through and have been going through for the past 100 years, not just 75 years, but since the very beginning of Zionism in the late 1800s. And I want to understand, you know, and I don't want to say the Jewish side, because Molly right here really exemplifies that there's not a Jewish side. The Jews are split on when it comes to Israel. And there are many Jews like Molly who say, I do not endorse Israel committing atrocity after atrocity after atrocity in my name. And what I've come to through my research is, you know, I feel a really significant amount of empathy for Jewish folks. And I understand, like, when you look at their history, this desire to have a place where they're safe, and I want that for them. But what I keep coming to in my own mind, and what I see my students coming through into in their own exploration, is them coming to that same empathy, but we all keep coming to this point where we're like, but not at the expense of Palestinians, but not at the expense of Palestinians. You can't build a world of safety, you know, by murdering people's children. That will never get you to a place of safety. And so my involvement, my activism since October 7th has definitely become much more intense, yeah.
And before I get to the next question, I just want to make sure if our listeners don't know, can you explain a little bit about the Nakba and the history there? Because you've both referenced it, and just to give a historical context there.
Yeah, Molly, do you want me to?
Sure. I know that you've been teaching about the Nakba lately.
That's true. I have. Yeah. Okay, sure. You know, 1940. So the Nakba, it has many names. So Palestinians call it the Nakba, but Israelis call it the War of Independence. And then other people call it the Arab-Israeli War. And essentially, it was the birth of Israel. So for many years, starting in the late 1800s, leading up to 1948, the Zionist movement was at first a very fringe movement of Jews around the world who said, you know, in order for Jews to be safe, Jews need to have their own country. And they briefly considered doing this in like, you know, somewhere in Africa, I can't remember. Do you remember, Molly? Like, it was like,
I think it was in Uganda.
Yeah, Uganda, Argentina. But then they decide, you know, we're probably going to get the most people to rally around if we do it in Palestine, because that's the historic Jewish homeland, is where our the religion originates from. And there's a sense of connection to it in the Jewish religion. And so they start to buy a lot of land in Palestine. So I kind of want to come back to this later, but I can go really deep into the history. But essentially, a lot of Palestinian land, because of an Ottoman land code, because Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire at the time, had to be registered according to this land code. And so a lot of the land was registered by absentee landlords who never lived there. Some of them were Arabs living in other places. Some were, there was a lot of like Greek Orthodox people who registered land, and a lot of it was registered. So Zionist organization came in and started buying up a lot of this land and moving Jews in. They would give Jews land to come in. And of course, as they came in, they kicked the Palestinians off the land who'd been living there for generations. And so that went on for decades. And so originally the population of Jews in Palestine was about 6%, and Jews, Christians, and Muslims all lived in general harmony. Like there was this beautiful story about Yosef Castel, who was a Jew who had been living in Palestine since 1492, when his family was expelled from Spain, living in harmony with Arab Palestinians and Muslims. There are even stories of like children, like mothers not being able to nurse their children, and like a Jewish mothers like nursing Arab babies, and like reverse. Like there's all gorgeous stories of general harmony. But the Zionist movement was very explicit that their goal was to create a Jewish only country, a place that was really just for Jews. And in doing so, kicked many Palestinians off their land. So by the time we get to 1947, the Jewish population of Palestine has gone from 6% to about a third of the population. And Great Britain at the time now controls Palestine. Sorry, I'm ranting. I'm going to wrap this up. But they control Palestine at the time, because this is after World War I. The Ottoman Empire collapses. Great Britain controls Palestine. Great Britain says with the Balfour Declaration, we're going to help the Zionist movement, you know, create a home in Palestine. But they are like, okay, I don't want to deal with this anymore, because there's violence now happening on both sides, because Palestinians are angry, they're getting kicked off their land. Jews are now angry because Great Britain starts to limit their immigration. So they are fighting. And Great Britain's like, I'm out of here. I don't want to deal with this anymore. And they give the British Mandate for Palestine to the UN, the new United Nations. And so the United Nations comes up with this partition plan, how they're going to split up the land. And essentially, even though at this point Jews are a third of the population and Arab Palestinians are two-thirds of the population, they end up giving essentially two-thirds of the land to the Jewish population and then about a third of the land to the Arab population. So Jews accept the plan and they're like, yay, we're going to get our country. But Arabs reject the plan because it's giving away two-thirds of their land. And so they fight back. They have this war, or as the Palestinians call it, the Nakba, which means catastrophe, and essentially 750,000 Palestinians are ethnically cleansed from their land. Now their descendants, they become refugees. And at this point, their descendants number about 7 million people, who many of them are still refugees today. Okay, that was a long way to answer that question, but like I told you, I'm researching.
But I think it's important because, you know, not everyone has this historical context, and really it's framed in particular ways in the media and without the historical context. So I think it's just really important for our listeners. So
Rachel, I think almost nobody has that historical context. And that's why I wanted to teach about this. You know, most people, if they talk about this, they'll say this goes back 75 years to 1948. And most people do not understand it goes back even further to the beginning of Zionism. And that's me as an educator, I feel this is my job. I need to provide this context to my students. This is one of the biggest issues of our time, and they have a right to know and understand the historical background to this situation. Because you're right, the media does not provide it.
Yeah. And so, and you're right that most, you know, classrooms are not teaching this. So no. where are people supposed to get this knowledge?
Yes.
So I know I kind of derailed us a little, but I thought it was super important. And we had you on, though, because both of you were targeted around your teaching and activism. And so if you would just share what you were targeted for, how you were notified, how you initially responded, what you were heard from principals and district administrators. Can you just share a little bit about that, please?
Sure. So, you know, I actually wasn't targeted. However, I, weird situation, but I'll explain it. And it ties into how Susanna was targeted. So, you know, look, I'm a little nervous to share this out publicly. But it is my responsibility to share out this information. Anything right now during a genocide, I think is important that we speak out about. So the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland, for those who don't know, which probably is most people, because it's a pretty insidious group who sort of paints themselves as this you know, benign community organization, when really they're mostly just a, you know, Israeli lobbying group. You know, they do some good for the community, the Jewish community of Portland, but mostly they're just, yeah, they're an Israeli lobbying group. They're deeply Zionist. So I got word that they were holding a Zoom meeting for concerned Portland public school parents who were, you know, really concerned about, in their words, the aggressive pro-Palestinian activism from the Portland Association of Teachers. And they were also really concerned about what they perceived as anti-Semitism in the schools and the student walkout. So I happened to be homesick from work that day, and I went to the meeting. And I heard a lot of really chilling, terrible stuff said during that meeting that made me really concerned for, you know, Palestinian students, as well as all students and Jewish students, right? Because this harms Jewish students too, let's be honest.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and really concerned about union members and fellow teachers. And I heard in the meeting them reference Susanna, not by name, but I knew that she had been teaching about the Nakba and about Israel and Palestine, and they were referencing some of her lessons. So I immediately got in touch with Susanna, as well as other community members, to make sure that we countered the Jewish Federation and came up with some plans to get as organized and as involved as they are, because they are pretty organized and involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, in some ways I have to say I admire their organizing. Like, they are so organized, and I'm like, wow, we need to be as organized. But because of their organizing, I'll tell you what happened to me. So, well, first I want to start by saying that so far PPS has not tried to interfere in what I'm actually teaching. Like, they have maintained my academic freedom. And I really hope that I can get to the end of this year and say that they continued to do that. So PPS, if you're listening, please do not interfere with our academic freedom. We have a right to teach the truth. But they have censored us in other ways. So first thing that happened, so Molly was in the meeting when a parent referenced some student work, some posters that students had made. And these posters were based on a lesson created by Bill Bigelow, who is, you know, the curriculum editor for Rethinking Schools and Zen Education, like co-director of the Zen Education Project, a legend in the teaching community. And he created this really great role play about the early days of Zionism. And at the end of the role play, so in the role play, students were one of 17 different roles of people who were affected by Zionism in some way. So some of them are like Theodor Herzl, who's the founder of Zionism, or other, you know, I'm trying to remember the specific names. I'm blanking on one of the names, but a Jewish person who from Russia who came. But then there's also people who support Zionism who are anti-Semitic, like Lord Balfour from the British Empire, who supported Zionism, you know, in part as a way to not have Jewish refugees come to Great Britain because he didn't want, as he said, undesirable immigrants. And then there's people who oppose Zionism, like Palestinians who are being kicked off their land. But also there are Jews in the role play who support, who oppose Zionism, like Patty Kramer from the Bund in Russia, who believed that Jews should be safe wherever they live. They shouldn't have to go somewhere else to be safe. And like I had mentioned before, like Yosef Castel, who had lived in Palestine, his family for hundreds of years in harmony with Palestinians and did not think it was a good idea to divide the land between a Jewish state and an Arab state and thought instead it made more sense to live in harmony together. So students read all these, they read one of these perspectives and then they meet each other in a role play, you know, and they do this mixer and they learn about all these different perspectives and then they come together in small groups and then their task was, okay, now you decide who or what is like at the root of this conflict. What is at the very root of this? And students are were encouraged to think about like, not just people, but like concepts, documents, empires, anything. And students came up with this like huge range. The most common thing that students came up with was anti-Semitism is the root of this conflict because it creates the need for Zionism. Some students chose Zionism. Some students chose the British Empire. Some students chose like the Ottoman Empire, the Balfour Declaration. Some students chose, one group came up with the belief that we cannot coexist equally is at the root of this conflict. And then they all made posters, and then they all chose one and they make posters about who's at the root of this conflict. And these posters are so, they are so historically accurate. Like they don't even say, like Molly had sent me the copy paste from the comment that was in that Jewish Federation meeting. And it was like a parent saying, these posters say Zionists are stealing land from Palestinians. The posters don't even say that. They say like in 1858, the Ottoman Land Code was passed that said that Palestinian land had to be registered. And so many of it was registered by absentee land. Like, you know, they're so historically accurate. They're beautiful. They represent such deep student learning. And I had these posters hung in the hallway. And so the first thing, so those, the student walkout gets the Jewish Federation parents upset. Then they hear about my posters and they've said, and they start organizing calls to the district. And I think they coordinated like thousands of calls to the district, which is, you got to admire, good organizing. but then, so I get the directive first that I need to take down my ceasefire posters. Now we have posters up in the school that say, my body, my choice. Like we have Black Lives Matter posters up around the school, protect trans kids posters all around the school. So when they told me I had to take down ceasefire, I said, okay, do you need me to take down Black Lives Matter? Do you need me to take down my poster, protect trans kids? Because you're telling me this is, I need to take it down because it's a political issue. And then I look up the political speech guidelines for PPS and they say we cannot, you know, oppose, like we cannot promote or oppose election petitions, ballot measures, candidates. And actually, I want to just get it because there's one more. It's election petitions, candidates, political committees, or ballot measures. Okay, that's not ceasefire. And then it goes on to say, it is also important to distinguish between speech that affirms our values and vision from political speech. In particular, language that supports our values of racial equity and social justice is not political speech. And it goes on to use Black Lives Matter as an example. And if we cannot, as a district, endorse a call for peace, a call to stop bombing children, and that's not our values and vision, then what does that say about us as a school community? So, of course, I refused, and I began by putting just like censored signs over the ceasefire words. And then other teachers in my school, it's actually, you know, yeah, so other teachers in my school started putting up the posters as well. And at first, the two teachers they asked to take the posters down were me and the only other Arab American teacher at the school. We were the first two asked to take our ceasefire posters down. And for a while, for a couple of days, we were the only two. And then they tell everyone they have to take them down, even though they have the censored thing up. And I was okay, fine. And at first it was, will you move those student posters into your classroom because it's harming students? Okay, which students are being harmed by this? And where have I heard this argument before, that teaching about social justice harms students? Because it sounds very much about what I'm hearing Ron DeSantis say and what I hear from the teachers in Newburgh, the admin in Newburgh say. And so they forced me to take those posters down, and then they forced me to take the student posters down. At first it was an ask, and then it was a force. So I take them down, and for every single poster that I took down, I put up a poster that said censored, so that people could see what this looks like to take all this diverse, beautiful student work and now see 100 censored posters up in their place. And then, of course, they make me take those down. But then, to me at this point, okay, now the lesson for my students is, how do we respond? Because what they want is for me to be scared. They want a chilling effect. They want all of us to be scared. They want us to feel like if we speak up for human rights and dignity for all people, including Palestinians, that we are going to be at risk of losing our jobs, at risk of harassment. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend I'm not scared. Yeah, I'm scared every day. I go into work thinking, oh my gosh, my email going to be flooded with hate mail. Like, do I have to have another meeting with admin today? I had one week where I had a meeting with admin every single day. But courage is about being afraid and doing the thing anyway. And we have to have some courage here, because they want us to be scared, and we need to show them, even if I am scared, I'm not going to sit here and say that it's okay to kill more than 13,000 children. Like, there is nothing that could ever in my mind justify killing 13,000 children. It's not justifiable.